The emotions of this protracted controversy were spent on the issue, is there evolution or is there not? More and more scientists subscribed to evolution. Religious minds clung to the belief that there had been no change since the creation of the world. Actually, the debate was between liberals and conservatives in the matter of science. The radicals did not participate, for catastrophism was dying out with the generation of the founders and classicists of geological science. Cuvier died in 1832. In England, geologists like Buckland of Oxford and Sedgwick of Cambridge, set in their belief in Mosaic tradition, ascribed the ubiquitous vestiges of the catastrophe to the action of the deluge. But they could not point to a satisfactory physical cause of such catastrophe. An expert estimate made it obvious that, had all the clouds over the earth emptied themselves simultaneously, the earth would not have been covered by even 1 foot of water. Then the geological record showed that there had been not one but several deluges. Lyell wrote in a letter, Cone, Baer, geologist and Bishop of Bristol, admits 3 deluges before the Nokel and Buckland adds God knows how many catastrophes besides, so we have driven them out of the Mosaic record fairly. Sedgwick, according to Lyell, decided on 4 or more deluges. In his last address as president of the Geological Society, Sedgwick admitted that his religious beliefs caused him to propagate a philosophic heresy. I think it right, as one of my last acts before I quit this chair, thus publicly to read my recantation. We ought, indeed, to have paused before we adopted the diluvian theory, and referred all our old superficial gravel to the action of the Mosaic flood. For of man, and the works of his hands, we have not yet found a single trace among the remnants of a former world entombed in these deposits. So where were the remains of the sinful population? Cuvier taught that man's remains were never found with those of extinct animals. Lyell also declared in the first edition of his Principles that man was created after all the extinct animals passed away, and not until 1858, a year before the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, did the finds in the Brixham Cave shatter this belief in the non-coexistence of man and extinct, or antediluvian, animals. In the year of the origin, the leading English geologists were finally convinced by J. B. de Perthes, a notary of Abbeville in France, who for 20 years fan only deaf ears, that human artifacts, worked flint, and extinct animals are met in the same formations, side by side. This opened wide the doors to Darwin's theory. By that time the doubts of the catastrophists, who could not understand why there were signs of more than one deluge and why there should be no human bones left of all the sinful generation that perished in the flood, had already brought about the abandonment of the theory of catastrophism, a theory that appeared to be in conflict with the Mosaic record. Thus it happened that the entire controversy for and against Darwinism failed to respond to the challenge of Darwin, who tried to show that what appeared to be the result of global catastrophes could be explained as the product of slow changes multiplied by time, with no violence intervening. The opposition was concentrated against the idea of evolution and in support of special creation, insisting that all animals were created in the forms in which they are found in our days. The opponents of evolution waged their battle on geologically indefensible ground. But why did Darwin oppose the idea of great catastrophes in the past, contrary to his own field observations, and subscribe to the theory of uniformity of geological events in all ages and in the present? For species to evolve as a result of incessant competition and struggle for survival, all the way from the simplest forms to Homo sapiens and other advanced organisms, an enormous span of time is required. The teaching of catastrophes appeared to make the story of the world very short. If the deluge occurred less than 5,000 years ago, then, following the book of Genesis, creation took place less than 6,000 years ago. In order to have at the disposal of the evolutionary process the almost unlimited time needed, Darwin accepted Lyell's teaching, and whereas Lyell tried to show that the usual agents, such as rivers carrying sediment, act with comparative speed, Darwin liked to stress their sluggishness. He wrote, "Therefore a man should examine for himself the great piles of superimposed strata, and watch the rivulets bringing down mud, and the waves wearing away the sea, cliffs, in order to comprehend something about the duration of past time. The waves of the sea reduce a rock particle by particle, and if a visible change is produced, it requires many thousands of years. Nothing impresses the mind with a vast duration of time, according to our ideas of time, more forcibly than the conviction thus gained that sub-aerial agencies which apparently have so little power, and which seem to work so slowly, have produced great results. Darwin even went so far as to suggest that he who can read Sir Charles Lyell's grand work on the principles of geology and yet does not admit how vast have been the past periods of time, may at once close this volume, Origin of Species, the Geological Record and Changing Forms of Life. His thesis of the origin of species by natural selection Darwin supported by reference to 1. Variations in domestic animals, especially when a breeder deliberately develops a certain desirable feature, 2. The anatomical similarity of many related species, and 3. The geological record. However, though breeders have created new races or variations, they have created no new animal species. In the anatomy of living creatures, the distinctness of the specific forms, and their not being blended together by innumerable transitional links, is a very obvious difficulty, and thus the entire weight of proof was placed on the geological record. This record shows, however, the forms of life changing almost simultaneously throughout the world, the title of a section in The Origin of Species. Darwin wrote, "Scarcely any paleontological discovery is more striking than the fact that the forms of life change almost simultaneously throughout the world. This appears baffling, because according to his theory the process of modification must be slow, and will generally affect only a few species at the same time, for the variability of each species is independent of that of all others. Could it not have been a sudden change in physical conditions that altered the forms of life at one and the same time throughout the world?" Darwin answers, "No. It is, indeed, quite futile to look to changes of currents, climate, or other physical conditions, as the cause of these great mutations in the forms of life throughout the world, under the most different climates. If the climate or other physical conditions changed in one part of the world, how could this alter forms of life in all the other parts of the world? That a change in physical conditions could have occurred all over the world at one and the same time, Darwin did not even take into consideration. What kind of an answer to his problem, therefore, could Darwin propose? Blank intervals of vast duration, as far as the fossils are concerned, occurred during these long and blank intervals. I suppose that the inhabitants of each region underwent a considerable amount of modification and extinction, hence the parallelism of changes in fauna and flora in similar strata around the world is not a true time parallelism. The order would falsely appear to be strictly parallel. Darwin then considered the absence of numerous intermediate varieties in any single formation, and wrote, "If we confine our attention to any one formation, it becomes much more difficult to understand why we do not therein find closely graduated varieties between the allied species which lived at its commencement and at its close." And he found the answer in the conjecture that although each formation may mark a very long lapse of years, each probably is short compared with the period requisite to change one species into another. Furthermore, the geological record shows the sudden appearance of whole groups of allied species, the title of another section in The Origin of Species. The abrupt manner in which whole groups of species suddenly appear in certain formations has been urged by several paleontologists, for instance, by Agassiz, Pictet, and Sedgwick, as a fatal objection to the belief in the transmutation of species. If numerous species, belonging to the same genera or families, have really started into life at once, the fact would be fatal to the theory of evolution through natural selection. For the development by this means of a group of forms, all of which are descended from some one progenitor, must have been an extremely slow progress, and the progenitors must have lived long before their modified descendants. Darwin explained this observation, too, by the incompleteness of the geological record, which, because of the lacunae, gives the appearance of sudden changes. The geological record of extinction of species is discussed under the heading, On extinction. Darwin wrote, "The extinction of species has been involved in the most gratuitous mystery. What took place is apparently sudden extermination of whole families or orders." According to his theory, the extinction of a whole group of species is generally a slower process than their production, and yet some groups were exterminated wonderfully sudden. Here, once more, Darwin thought that the imperfection of the geological record may in some cases simulate the suddenness of the extinction, but he acknowledged in other cases his inability to explain the spontaneity of the extinction of some species. He still wondered, as in the days of his South American travels, why horses had disappeared in pre-Columbian America, where they had every favorable condition for propagation. And in a letter to Sir Henry H. Haworth, he acknowledged his inability to explain the extinction of the mammoth, a well-adapted animal. But in general, the deficiency of the geological record was invoked to explain the apparent spontaneity of extinction, as well as the suddenness with which new species seem to have arrived on the scene. According to the theory of natural selection, chance variations or new characteristics among individuals of a species, if beneficial, are exploited in the struggle for survival and, being inheritable, may by accumulation lead to the origin of a new species. Because of the chance nature of these new characteristics and therefore also of the origin of the new species, Darwin assumed that not only all the individuals of the same species have migrated from some one area, but that allied species, although now inhabiting the most distant points, have proceeded from a single area, the birthplace of their early progenitors. The belief that a single birthplace is the law seems to me incomparably the safest. Darwin explained the migration of plants from continent to continent and from mainland to islands by the transportation of seeds in the intestines of birds, the migration of mollusks, by observed instances of small shells clinging to the legs of migrating birds. This method of dispersion does not account for the geographical distribution of larger animals unable to fly or swim across the sea, or traverse climatic zones unsuitable for the species. Since animals of such species are found in very distant parts of the globe, divided by oceans, Darwin was led to maintain that during the vast geographical and climatal changes which have supervened since ancient times, almost any amount of migration is possible. This makes necessary the existence of land connections or land bridges between islands and mainlands and between all continents. But to these geographical and climatal changes, the Ice Age included, Darwin ascribed a subordinate role in shaping the development of the animals. They played an important role only in the migration of the animals. Where the land is continuous, as in the Americas, Darwin accounted for the fact that identical animals live in higher latitudes of the southern and northern hemispheres, though they are absent in temperate and tropical latitudes, by resorting to a theory which assumes that the glacial periods in the northern and southern hemispheres were not simultaneous but consecutive. When a glacial period was descending upon the north, animals migrated slowly to the south, toward the equator. When the glacial period ended, and the climate in the subtropics became hot, some animals returned to the north, others remained in the subtropical regions, climbing the cool mountains. When the next glacial age, this time advancing from the south, arrived, the animals on the mountains came down, and when this age also ended, some of them moved to the south, while others again retreated to the mountains. Thus, identical animals are found in the cooler regions of both the northern and southern hemispheres. At present, means the late 50s, this view of consecutive glacial periods in the northern and southern hemispheres has hardly any adherents. The theory of evolution by natural selection could not do well without the theory of the ice ages. It needed the ice age theory to explain the provenience of the same species in the southern and northern hemispheres separated by the torrid zone. It needed it even more to account for the phenomenon of drift. Erratic blocks could have been explained, with some straining, by the action of icebergs. But drift, or accumulation of clay, boulders, and sand that in many places fills valleys hundreds of feet deep, could not have been brought in by icebergs. And, finally, icebergs, in order to be produced in great numbers, themselves required extended glaciers from which they could break off. Darwinian evolution needed the Ice Age theory in order to supplant the tidal wave theory, which is a catastrophic notion. Darwin accepted Agassiz's teaching, though not in its original form with a catastrophic beginning of the Ice Ages. But Agassiz rejected Darwin's theory. The reason for this he saw in the skeletal remains of ancient fish, a field in which he was an authority. In many instances the fish of extinct species were better developed and further advanced in their evolution than later species, the modern included. Among mammals, too, many better developed species became extinct. But these difficulties in the way of the evolutionary theory were less strongly felt in the heat of the fight against the opponents who insisted on a 6,000-year-old world and the immutability of species. Darwin's theory represented progress as compared with the teachings of the Church. The Church assumed a world without change in nature since the beginning. Darwin introduced the principle of slow but steady change in one direction, from one age to another, from one eon to another. In comparison with the Church's teaching of immutability, Darwin's theory of slow evolution through natural selection or the survival of the fittest was an advance, though not the ultimate truth. The story of his experiences is told by his contemporary and adherent, Thomas Huxley. Darwin was held up to scorn as a flighty person, who endeavors to prop up his utterly rotten fabric of guess and speculation, and whose mode of dealing with nature is reprobated as utterly dishonorable to natural science. Thus Huxley quoted from an article by Bishop Wilberforce in the Quarterly Review of July 1860. Huxley also wrote in 1887, "On the whole, then, the supporters of Mr. Darwin's views in 1860 were numerically extremely insignificant. There is not the slightest doubt that, if a general council of the Church scientific had been held at that time, we should have been condemned by an overwhelming majority. And there is as little doubt that, if such a council gathered now, the decree would be of an exactly contrary nature." Darwin's Origin of Species, Huxley went on, was badly received by the generation to which it was first addressed, and the outpouring of angry nonsense to which it gave rise is sad to think upon. But the present generation will probably behave just as badly if another Darwin should arise, and inflict upon them that which the generality of mankind most hate, the necessity of revising their convictions. Let them, then, be charitable to us ancients, and if they behave no better than the men of my day to some new benefactor, let them recollect that, after all, our wrath did not come to much, and vented itself chiefly in the bad language of sanctimonious scolds. Let them as speedily perform a strategic right, about, face, and follow the truth wherever it leads. The opponents of the new truth will discover, as those of Darwin are doing, that, after all, theories do not alter facts, and that the universe remains unaffected even though texts crumble. The mechanism of evolution. Natural selection, the Darwinian mechanism of evolution, is simultaneously destructive and constructive. In the struggle for existence it eliminates all the unfit among the members of a species, and it destroys the species that cannot compete with others for the limited resources of livelihood. The winners in this struggle are those individuals that because of some characteristic, or favorable variation, have an edge over other competitors. Under these circumstances favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones destroyed. The result of this would be the formation of new species, Darwin. As shown on previous pages, the annihilation of many individuals and of entire species in the animal kingdom took place, not only under circumstances of competition, but under catastrophic conditions as well. Entire species with no sign of degeneration suddenly came to their end in paroxysms of nature. Yet extinction of a species through starvation or extermination by enemies also takes place. Moa, the gigantic flightless bird of New Zealand that stood 12 feet high, was destroyed several centuries ago. The whooping cranes of North America were reduced by 1,953 to 21 individuals. Natural selection cannot account for the wholesale destruction of many genera and species at one time. It may occasionally be the agent exterminating single species. But can natural selection create new species? The geological record presents evidence that in the past animals lived that do not live any longer, and also that, of the forms living today, many did not exist in the past. Then how did they come into being? The animal and plant kingdoms are subdivided into phyla, and these into classes, orders, families, genera, and finally species. A species can be recognized this way. The mating of members of two different species generally does not produce offspring, and when it does, such offspring is sterile. Horse and ass, and their offspring, the mule. Thus all the human race is but one species, and all races of dogs, so dissimilar in their body structures, are members of one species. There are hundreds of thousands of species in the animal kingdom and also in the plant kingdom. In the theory of evolution, all forms of life evolved by gradual emergence from the same most primitive, one, cell living beings. Chance variations occur in members of every species, no two individuals are entirely identical. These variations are inheritable. As already explained, the favorable variations, those that are helpful in the struggle for existence, may accumulate to such a degree that, according to Darwin, a new species originates, the members of which can have no fruitful progeny with the members of the parental species. Since the first scientific observations were made, no truly new animal species has been observed to come into being. The year after publication of The Origin of Species, Thomas Huxley wrote, "But there is no positive evidence, at present, that any group of animals has, by variation and selective breeding, given rise to another group which was, even in the least degree, infertile with the first." A few years later Darwin wrote in a letter, to Bentham, "The belief in natural selection must at present be grounded entirely on general considerations. When we descend to details we cannot prove that a single species has changed, nor can we prove that the supposed changes are beneficial, which is the groundwork of the theory." And at the end of the century Huxley found himself compelled to make the statement, "I remain of the opinion that until selective breeding is definitely proved to give rise to varieties infertile with one another, the logical foundation of the theory of natural selection is incomplete. We still remain very much in the dark about the causes of variation. In selective breeding the breeder creates conditions not found in wildlife, and new races or varieties of animals created by selection and isolation revert to their ancestral unselected forms as soon as they are turned free. Thus, when dogs of various breeds mate they give birth to mongrels which resemble their common ancestors. Despite all their efforts, breeders have not been able to cross the true frontier of a species. Then how could a new species originate in chance variations and through crossbreeding in wildlife? And how could so many new species be produced that they number, together with the extinct, in the millions? And how could a human being, so complicated, evolve, not just from common ancestors with the primates, apes, but from common ancestors with winged insects and crawling worms?" The evolutionists drew more checks on time. Then, too, the chance character of variations, when they first appear in an individual, makes the envisaged progress especially difficult. Darwin professed ignorance as to the cause of these variations or new characteristics appearing in individuals, and it was generally understood that chance variations, in the vast majority of cases, must be in the nature of defects. In a complicated and balanced organism, a chance variation would probably be a hindrance, not a benefit. Then by what rare accidents could ever more perfected species have originated? Various theories have been offered, one of them being evolution created by Henri Bergson, that assume the existence of a guiding principle in evolution, which replaces the chance and accident in variations. These theories are often united under the name orthogenesis, the best known of such ideas. The adherents of orthogenesis claim the existence of a plan and a goal. But since, in such a theory, providence enters into action, and to make nature independent of it was a major objective of the theory of evolution as opposed to the teaching of special creation, after some deliberation orthogenesis, or creative evolution, met largely with rejection. The orthogeneticists could argue that many traits, when they first appeared, must have been entirely useless, yet not senseless if they were destined to become useful after many generations. Then why should these traits have gone on developing from age to age, finally to become an asset to the species? Unless orthogenesis was in action, why should the pocket of the kangaroo have increased in size through many generations until it could be used for carrying baby kangaroos? The obvious difficulty in explaining the evolutionary process by chance variations brought about the revival of Lamarckism. In 1809, the year Darwin was born, Lamarck had published his Philosophic Zoologique, in which he offered a theory of evolution through the appearance of new traits and faculties in response to usage, usage in response to need, and need as the consequence of changes in physical surroundings. These new acquired traits, he assumed, were inheritable. Lamarck also taught uniformity, and thus he was an opponent of his contemporary, Cuvier, who taught catastrophism. Charles Darwin, generous to Alfred R. Wallace, whom he declared to be an independent discoverer of the theory of natural selection, never agreed, despite the admonitions of Lyell and Huxley, to acknowledge his death to Lamarck. In a letter to Lyell, he referred to Lamarck's book as absurd and rubbish, and also as a wretched book. However, Darwin offered the theory of pangenesis, according to which every cell in the body of an animal or plant sends an invisible image of the parent cell to the germ cells. In this way, Darwin intended to interpret heredity. Thus, he went even farther than Lamarck in making the cells of the body the carriers of heredity, which amounts to hereditary transmission of acquired traits. The theory of pangenesis is definitely rejected by everyone. In the battle that went on among the representatives of different schools in evolution, the neo-Darwinists, led by August Wiseman, attacked the neo-Lamarckists. And by cutting off the tails of mice in succeeding generations, Wiseman could show that acquired traits are not inheritable. Actually, he did not prove that much. The loss of tails by cutting is not a habit or trait acquired through usage or need. It was Wiseman who really disproved Darwin's pangenesis theory, not Lamarck, but he properly stressed that the carriers of hereditary traits are in the germ plasma, or in spermatozoa and ova, the soma, or the body, is created in each successive generation by the germ plasma, and only changes in the plasma are inheritable. The chance variations of Darwin are such changes in the germ plasma and are therefore inherited. The response of the body to external agents would not create inheritable traits and therefore must be of no value in evolution. On evolution as a geological fact, all agreed, but on the mechanism of evolution, the disagreement has been fundamental. The majority of evolutionists have rejected the idea that acquired characteristics are inheritable, but Lamarck's ideas found followers in the East, in Majorin, who experimented on plants, and for a time in Pavlov, who experimented on animals, and not long ago in the dominant school of thought in Russia. The neo-Darwinists deny that physical surroundings can give rise to new species. They may bring about changes in an organism, but the acquired characteristics are not inheritable. Can, then, natural selection or competition with other animals create new species? The classic example of a giraffe with the longest neck surviving when leaves are left only high on the trees does not prove that giraffes with longer necks would become a separate species. And, in any event, under the described conditions, no new race would evolve. The female giraffes, which are smaller in stature, would die out before the male competitors, and there would be no progeny. But should there be progeny, the young giraffes would probably die because they would be unable to reach the leaves. The position of Darwinists would be much stronger if a new animal species would appear, even if only in controlled breeding. Darwin claimed that the process of the appearance of new species is very slow, but he also maintained that the process of extinction of a species is even slower. Nevertheless, some species of animals have expired before the eyes of the naturalists, but no new one has appeared. The theory of natural selection, even the very fact of the evolvement of one species from another, needed proof. Some scientists went so far as to say that possibly the entire development plan has already reached its permanent stage, and the geological records tell only of the road to that stage, evolution no longer taking place. One part of the Darwinian theory of selection has been generally abandoned. It is the idea of sexual selection as a factor in evolution. In natural selection, the competition is for the means for existence. In sexual selection, a theory developed in The Descent of Man, 1871, the competition is among the males for acceptance by a female.